World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. This program is presented in behalf of Admiral dealers all over America by shortwave broadcast direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers in our own country. CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Robert Trout.
Slowly and steadily, the occupation of Japan goes on, and in the outposts of what was the stolen Japanese Empire, the authority of the Allies spreads out over larger areas, and the rule of Japan fades. It has not yet vanished. The Japanese forces in China have surrendered in Nanking. In Saigon, the capital of Indochina, British troops stand guard in the streets, and so do the soldiers of Japan. Until Indochina is securely in Allied control, the Japanese have been told that they are responsible for order. But for weeks now, the Japanese have been stirring up the natives, encouraging them to riot, and the result now is trouble in Saigon, although it is not clear whether it's trouble on a large scale. The latest reports tell of the natives murdering two French officers who parachuted into the city, and riots in front of the Continental Hotel, where a mob tried, apparently without success, to reach French refugees who had taken shelter in the hotel. From Korea, there's a report of bloodshed. Some 500 Korean workmen carrying small American flags but no weapons were marching to the docks at the port of Jinsen to welcome the first wave of American troops. Before the first American boat reached shore, Japanese police fired into the crowd, killing some, wounding others. But the enthusiasm of the Korean population is obviously not easily smothered. As the American troops marched inland from Jinsen to the capital, Seoul, they're showered with baskets of flowers, and they're cheered endlessly as liberators by these people who have lived under Japanese occupation for more than a generation. There are cheers and scenes of jubilation in Singapore, too, where the former Japanese conquerors have been put to work with pick and shovel in the public streets by a British commander who understands the psychology of the Far East. On the island of Hong Kong, from which all Japanese were supposed to have been removed, snipers have fired on British sailors. In the home islands of Japan, no such incidents of shooting have been reported by Allied correspondents, although the Japanese radio has occasionally broadcast denunciations of American behavior, and it has been reported unofficially that the Japanese Foreign Office is sending a steady stream of complaints to Allied headquarters. Today, the Supreme Allied Commander issued a statement dealing with the policy of the occupying powers. General MacArthur said that at the time of the Japanese surrender, the invasion plans were in their final stages, and those plans included provisions for a military government of Japan, which would have been necessary, the Supreme Commander says, because an invasion destroys or impairs organized government. But there was no invasion, and Japan still has a government, which is in working order, and is, the general says, apparently making every effort to execute the Allied instructions that have been given to it so far. These instructions, to date, consist of the surrender document signed aboard the battleship Missouri, and General Orders 1 and 2, which concern the disarming of the Japanese nation and the release of Allied prisoners. The point is, what will be the future orders which the Japanese government is instructed to carry out? General MacArthur, in his statement, says the objectives are to abolish militarism and militant nationalism, to create conditions which will ensure that Japan will not again become a menace to the world, and to encourage liberal tendencies, freedom of speech, religion, press, and assembly, subject to the necessity for maintaining military security. This last objective is not set forth in particularly emphatic language. It remains to be seen whether merely encouraging freedom in Japan will be enough to give freedom a fair chance of taking root. At any rate, the Japanese are to have at least the first opportunity of doing what is necessary themselves, with little interference from the occupation forces. For the Supreme Commander says the occupation forces will act principally as an agency to secure compliance, if necessary, with the Allied instructions. Meanwhile, the existing Japanese economy will be controlled only to the extent necessary to achieve the objectives, and the Japanese will be completely free from all unwarranted interference with their individual and with their property rights. It would seem from this that the velvet glove will remain upon the Allied hand until the Japanese government rebels at some instruction, and the test will consist of the kind of orders the Supreme Commander issues. And now for a recorded report by CBS correspondent William J. Dunn in Tokyo, Admiral takes you to San Francisco.
This uncanny, unbelievable peacetime occupation of Japan has produced some amazing situations in the past 10 days. The sight of bowing, smiling Japanese serving dinner to their one-time arch enemy, General of the Army Douglas MacArthur. The sight of all the Allied ranks in the Pacific on a single ship in Tokyo Harbor, and not a Jap plane paying any attention. The sight of war correspondents, alone and often unarmed, wandering at will about unoccupied areas. These and 100 other things have combined to give events of the past days a decidedly dreamlike quality. But one of the most amazing situations of the occupation is that which finds the American press, the Allied press, taking a consistent licking from the Japanese government news agency, Domai, because of circumstances beyond their control. It seems that Domai, through frequent references to the Potsdam Declaration, though what bearing that document has on the situation isn't clear, has managed to escape Allied censorship so far, and nothing has been done to deter the Japanese government from making public any directives from the Supreme Commander's staff. Just why the Japanese government should be able to clear news faster than the General Staff isn't clear to anyone, particularly the Press Relations Department, which is taking a terrific beating from the correspondents. But the fact remains that Domai has been broadcasting information as much as 72 hours before it is available to the Allied press. And that fact is not catching sunshine and light among members of the press corps. For instance, the representatives of one of the leading press associations only a few hours ago received a long list of dates of future occupational landings in these islands. His home office had copied them from a Domai broadcast and wanted to know two things. First, were they correct? And if so, why hadn't he sent them along? The press spokesman scanned the list, which had not been released to the Allied press, and announced that two of the dates listed had since been changed. The correspondent asked which ones had been changed, and was told that he couldn't be informed until a final list had been okayed by the Supreme Commander. There is nothing, however, to keep Domai from releasing those changes and bringing its still exclusive list of future landings up to date as soon as the Jap government is notified. That is only one instance. Others have happened with disconcerting regularity and will continue until there is a radical change in policy. The Allied press is the best in the world, but even the best is powerless against the system that deliberately hurls vital information to the other side and withholds it from its own. This is William J. Dunn in Tokyo.
Another of our Pacific correspondents has just returned to Advance Fleet headquarters from Japan on his way to China. For his story concerning GI reaction to the Japanese people, Admiral takes you now to Guam, Webley Edwards reporting.
One of the difficult tasks facing our American forces in Japan is to make ourselves believe that these docile, dirty, ragged, and patched-up Japanese are the people we have so cordially hated. We've had good reason to hate them. The Japanese we met in the field were possessed of an animal-like brutality, barbaric, treacherous, and fiendish. These are the people back in the Japanese homeland were a part of the system that produced the Japanese way of life, give the substance for Japan's elegant military system. And in many more than one instance, Japanese civilians, including women and children, showed the same inhuman cruelty and mad dog brutality toward captured U.S. airmen that their soldiers had shown in the field. Yet, as we went into Japan, I saw very little hate in the faces of our men. They were curious at first to see what manner of people these were. They were firm and cold toward them. But Americans seem to be Americans, and it's the nature of our people to want to help the unfortunate, to pity the underdog. Some of us had been through the prison camps and learned of the horror and unbelievable bestiality of the Japanese prison camps and the unrestrained punishment the Japs had meted out, often, and at the slightest excuse. And yet, with those memories still fresh, we had to put down a growing tendency to feel sorry for these pitiful Japanese people. We would say to ourselves, we must remember that these are the same people. That these same little people could and would do it again if their leaders thought they had the advantage. Somehow, as one Navy officer told me, we must change these people's way of thinking. We must revolutionize their entire education system, their politics, and their economy for the future security of world peace. Japan, he said, is potentially a mad dog nation. That's what we have to remember. This is Webley Edwards in Guam. I return you to Admiral in New York.
Next, a word from Warren Sweeney. There's a brand new star in the Admiral's sky, and it's ready for sale now. It's the Admiral Lifetime Precious Jewel Phonograph Needle. There has long been a need for a needle that would bring out the delicate overtones and shadings of your favorite music on records and stand continuous use over a long period of time. The Admiral Lifetime Precious Jewel Needle, with its genuine sapphire point, fills that need. Here at last is a needle that will really make your records come to life. You'll get finer record reproduction and longer record life. And listen to this. Each Admiral Lifetime Precious Jewel Needle will play up to 10,000 records. That's right, up to 10,000 plays from each Admiral Lifetime Jewel Needle. Get one of these genuine sapphire point needles tomorrow from your Admiral dealer. He'll have them prominently shown in a beautiful, illuminated stage-setting display. Each needle is packaged in an attractive lucite container, sealed in to ensure its perfect condition. They're guaranteed by Admiral, the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers, and makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Now, here once again is Robert Trout. Diplomats from the Big Five powers are arriving in London for the meeting of their foreign ministers. For this and other news, Admiral takes you to CBS London, Charles Shaw reporting.
This is Charles Shaw in London. All the smiles of diplomacy are being flashed as statesmen from all over the world gather in London to discuss the future of Europe. But those smiles at the moment are masks covering grim visages. And statesmanship of the highest order will be needed to turn them into smiles of satisfaction and agreement. The magnet attracting so many diplomats, from the Balkans to Australia, is the Big Five Foreign Ministers meeting, which begins Tuesday. The Chinese and French, and naturally the British Foreign Ministers, now are in this country. Secretary of State Burns will arrive tomorrow. As usual, secrecy colors the movements of Russian Foreign Minister Molotov, and a Soviet spokesman, after insisting all afternoon that he knew nothing of Mr. Molotov's plans, finally stuck his neck out far enough to say the foreign minister probably will be here tomorrow morning. When the foreign ministers sit down at Lancaster House at 2:30 Tuesday afternoon, the first thing they're supposed to do is discuss a peace treaty with Italy. That in itself is enough to stir up a hornet's nest. Because Yugoslavia, Greece, France, and Austria definitely want slices of pre-war Italian territory. Egypt and Ethiopia are interested in Italian African colonies. Australia wants something to say about the future of Italian territories, which Australians helped to recapture. Peace treaties with Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary are to be drafted. The British and Americans don't like their governments. The Russians do. Some agreement has to be reached on the complexion of the Balkan governments before we can talk peace with them. The foreign ministers also are scheduled to talk about the evacuation of Allied troops from Iran. Most of the Americans are gone. The British want to get out, but the Russians have shown no disposition to leave. Also on the agenda is a proposal that certain European waterways be internationalized. The Russians are known to want a more favorable position in respect to the Dardanelles, and that promises to be a thorny subject. As a sidelight, the French will press their claim for severance of the Ruhr and the Rhineland from Germany, and probably will try to conclude a favorable treaty with Great Britain. The foreign ministers have a big job cut out for them in a meeting expected to last only 2 weeks. And whatever they decide, they'll have to refer to their governments, and finally to the United Nations organization. Meanwhile, the British are becoming more and more incensed by stories of Japanese atrocities which continue to pour in here. such usually non-British expressions as wipe that grin off those yellow faces and punish the whole Jap gang are carried by today's London press. One paper speaks of devilish cruelty, endorsing General Stilwell's published statement, let us not be too kind to the Japanese. Another writer demands that we treat Japan with a firm hand. These demands are echoed by the ordinary people who are shocked that such barbarity could be practiced in the 20th century. This is Charles Shaw in London. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
In this country, Washington is preparing to honor General Wainwright. For this and other news, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Tris Coffin reporting.
Some people say that Washington is a cold and unfriendly city, but I think tomorrow Washington will give the lie to that description. For at that time, the nation's capital will welcome a man who's become a legend and a symbol, General Jonathan Wainwright. More than 1 million people are expected to stand for hours to catch a glimpse of a man who experienced the extremes of humiliation and triumph. He will address both houses of Congress and be received by the president. General Wainwright has become a symbol of all the suffering, sacrifice, and frustration of a nation at war. He will be honored as such. These ceremonies will take up most of the afternoon and divert attention momentarily from the baffling problems of reconversion piling up on the desks of Congress and government executives. The Department of Agriculture, for example, is stuck with a harsh paradox. It has a huge surplus of potatoes and no way to dispose of them. Meanwhile, millions of people the world over will feel hunger this winter. The armed forces have been a great consumer of spuds, as every GI knows. The end of the war cut back Army and Navy purchases of potatoes. A 441 million bushel crop is being forecast. This is 70 million bushels larger than last year. Under price support legislation passed by Congress, the Department of Agriculture is directed to buy food surpluses to prevent a drop in farm prices. During the war, the department disposed of these surpluses largely through lend-lease. That, of course, is no longer possible. United Nations Relief, which might well want to buy the surplus potatoes, has no funds. So the Department of Agriculture experts figure they'll be stuck with from 20 to 30 million bushels of potatoes. The only suggestion right now around the department is to convert the potatoes into starch. The department is not saying too much about it publicly, but behind the scenes it is throwing its weight against the lifting of food rationing. Officials there with whom I have talked are very concerned. They say, with some logic, that if controls are ever lifted, they will never go back on again. They say that if a way is found to finance foreign food purchases, a tremendous strain will be placed on some lines of American farm production. There might be shortages, or rather less than we would like to have, in meats, fats and oils and sugar for some time to come. Tomorrow, President Truman's reconversion program faces its first test in Congress. The chances are the administration will lose on this issue. The proposal to increase jobless insurance payments to a top of $25 a week for 26 weeks. Chairman George of the Senate Finance Committee is calling for a showdown with the committee. A good many members would rather let the bill die without a vote. The Finance Committee is one of the most conservative in the Capitol. Out of 21 members, only 6 can be counted definitely as for the measure. I return you to Admiral in New York.
One of Columbia's correspondents has just completed a 3,000-mile trip in the Balkans. For his report, Admiral takes you to CBS Paris. Douglas Edwards reporting.
This story really began in Munich, Germany, but it's about 7 million Greeks, those who haven't been to their homeland for years, and those at home who've suffered through the war and are still not listed among the world's most fortunate. Several other correspondents and I flew to Munich on Friday to see how the 442nd Troop Carrier Group of the United States Army Air Force is operating right now on a peacetime mercy mission. For about 3 weeks, the crews of the 442nd and their C-47s have been flying Greek displaced persons from a collection center in Munich to Athens. 6,500 will have been taken home when the job's finished. About half that number already are in Greece. And I might say here that there are thousands of others all over Europe who await the opportunity of getting back to what they hope will be a happier life.
Unfortunately, the flight we were supposed to accompany was canceled. The reason being a strike in Greece of considerable proportions, big enough to cut down the staff of local people who help service the ATC base in Athens. And that very situation makes a more vital story in itself. Our accompanying officer, Major Haynes Thompson of Montgomery, Alabama, and our pilot, Captain Norman Statham of Atlanta, were very readily agreed to fly us correspondents down to Athens to look into the other end of the story. We paid a visit first to the Munich camp, talked to many of the Greeks there, found they had either volunteered for work in Germany as an alternative to slow death by starvation, or had been taken as slave labor. They were being given a fairly good care, and they weren't getting a top diet, but there was no illness. Some of them had not heard from their families for months, and they were afraid of what they might find when they arrived. Yesterday morning, we took off from Munich at dawn, flew through Brenner Pass as the sun came up and sprinkled a million colors over the Alps, then on down to Foggia, Italy, and then to Athens. We learned from UNRWA officials there that the displaced persons on arrival in Greece were taken by UNRWA to a reception center, turned over to Greek officials, and then sent to their homes in various sections of the country. And now a few observations on Greece itself. Several thousand workers are out on strike, and why? Deputy Prime Minister K. Varvaressos resigned this week because he thought he was not getting the proper cooperation from labor and industry. With him went his system of price control, and up went prices overnight. In 4 days, prices in Greece have gone up to 40 to 50%. The workers are demanding double their present pay, which is about 80 cents a day. As it now stands, it's 4 to 5 times higher than they got before the war. The communist KKE, one of Greece's 30 political parties, is supporting the strike, and they're powerful agitators. From those with whom I talked in Athens, there is the definite possibility of a general strike, such as the one last December, perhaps in a day or so. With Regent Demaskinos in London, this situation develops at a very critical time. And in thumbnail sketch, other observations. Before the war, olive oil sold at 8 cents per 2¾ pounds. It now sells at $6. It's possible to buy a splendid meal, oddly enough, with meat and fish and wine at American price levels. Greece is having her worst drought in 25 years. The hills are barren and parched. The wheat crop this year is almost non-existent. UNRWA will have to bring more in. There is undernourishment, but no starvation. Demaskinos is expected to advise the British to hold off a plebiscite on the return of the king. However, if the election scheduled for November were held now, I'm told, the monarchist party probably would win. But it's impossible, as you know, to forecast the political temperature of a country which has had no election in 10 years. The Greeks like the country, they like the few Americans there, they dislike the British. The KKE has demanded the British leave. The best-informed Greeks are convinced they now are merely a British mandate. And this is Douglas Edwards in Paris, returning you to Admiral in New York.
General MacArthur issued a statement to all troops under his command today, and he said, "I know that the greatest reward you ask for your courage and devotion to service is the speedy return to your homes. The answer to your question, when will I go home, depends to a major degree upon the manner in which those of us assigned to the occupation forces carry out our mission." And now to tell you of a brand new electric range that will give you all the latest features in automatic cooking, here's Warren Sweeney.
It's the remarkable new electric range you'll get from Admiral. Surveys among housewives show there'll be a decided swing toward cooking with electricity. Because electric cooking is so clean, there's never any smoke or grime. And especially fortunate will be those homemakers who buy Admiral electric ranges with all the Admiral exclusive features. With an Admiral, you'll get FlexoHeat, the new and different method of heat regulation. With Admiral FlexoHeat, you'll be able to get just the correct amount of heat needed for every cooking operation. Easy to operate, too, as easy as turning on or off a water faucet. You'll like the automatic features of your new Admiral range, the deep well cooker that will perfectly prepare a whole meal while you're away from home. The Admiral oven, too, will give both time and temperature automatic cooking. Yes, if you're thinking of an electric range, be sure to see your Admiral dealer first. Remember, for the best in cookery, use electricity. For the best in electric cookery, choose an Admiral. Today, the nation's hospitals are caring for a record-breaking number of patients, and they are seriously handicapped by a shortage of nursing and auxiliary personnel. The Cadet Nurse Corps of the United States Public Health Service now has openings for several thousand more cadet nurses. Young women between 17 and 35 with a high school education are eligible to apply. Get all the necessary information and details from your local hospital. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set, Admiral Dual Temp Refrigerators, Admiral Home Freezers, Admiral Electric Ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.